Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. My name is Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. Now, how's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? I hope you are fantastic on this day here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, I've got a banger of an episode with Alex Edelman from Lolly. But before we dive in, let's check in with Swan. Swan Bitcoin is the best place to stack sats in the United States. Automatic recurring buys as cheap as they get in this country. 99 basis points, that's 0.99%, are your fees when you're stacking more than $200 per month and you prepay your fees annually, which is a great deal. And get you some skin in the game with those annual fees, all right? You know, you get some skin in the game, we all know what happens. You commit to that stacking process because, hey, you've already paid the fees, even though they're really low. Just that little bit of skin in the game will keep you stacking. And sometimes we all need that, right? And if you do want to buy the dip, all right, if you're one of those Bitcoiners that are far along, down the path of conviction, that you just want to buy that dip and you get excited when price goes down, we've got the smash button. All right, go in and click buy instantly, add to your stack. This is maybe the best way to accumulate Bitcoin, I think, is the formula is simple. Just keep dollar cost averaging with whatever excess income you have. Pay yourself in Bitcoin after you pay all your fiat bills. Pay the rest of it in Bitcoin. You deserve it. Bitcoin respects you. Fiat does not. And then you smash buy, when you get bullish or when you feel like the price is dipped enough, kind of buy that price all the way down that dip. And keep stacking. You'll be shocked at how much Bitcoin you have 12 months from now if you just follow that simple formula that Swan makes super easy. We also have Swan Private now for high net worth individuals, for trusts. I was thinking about Prime Trust, our banking and custodial partner. But for trusts, for corporations, for high net worth individuals, etc. If you're planning on stacking more than $100,000 worth of Bitcoin in the next 12 months, then you can stack with Swan Private. Go to swanbitcoin.com/private. Here's the key. You can do this anywhere in the world, all right? So this Swan Private is available to anyone in the world. We are really excited about that. So wherever you are in the world, please go to swanbitcoin.com/private if you're looking to stack at least $100,000 in Bitcoin this year. We're onboarding all kinds of companies from small to large who are converting portions of their treasury over to Bitcoin or all of their treasury over to Bitcoin. We're seeing lots of nonprofits. We're seeing lots of trust funds, trust accounts that are being put into children's, grandchildren's names, etc. So it's a lot of fun. What's going on over at Swan Private? Check it out. swanbitcoin.com/privates. As ever, thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network and Bitcoin Magazine for including this podcast in their collection of fantastic Bitcoin podcasts at letstalkbitcoin.com. Bitcoin Magazine, BTC Media in general, crushing it. Check out Bitcoin 2021 coming up in June in Miami. It's going to be amazing. Swan's going to have a big presence. We're really excited about what will be the biggest and best Bitcoin conference in the history of Bitcoin. So make sure you check out Bitcoin 2021. Shout out to BTC Media and the crew over there. CK, appreciate you, man. Thank you for supporting Citizen Bitcoin. All right, we're going to jump into this one with Alex Edelman. This is a great episode with Alex Edelman. We had a really fun discussion. Alex has been an entrepreneur basically from birth. He's been building companies from the time he was a teenager. We get into his history of entrepreneurship, why he, was so motivated to be an entrepreneur, what moves him to build companies. And we talk, of course, about Lolly, big success in the Bitcoin space, a fantastic Bitcoin-only company, allows you to earn free money when you shop. You can check that out at lolly.com. And we get into some Bitcoin little side rabbit holes and just kind of follow them along in this conversation, a back and forth. I think it was just a good kind of hangout between two Bitcoiners. Hope you all enjoy it. Here we go. But let's start by talking about Lolly. It's, I assume growing like a weed still, and you know, enough to the point where you guys are raising $1 billion for some Bitcoin.
Yeah. only half trolling.
Only half trolling. You guys are going to try to get some. I mean, it's the play, right? Right.
Yeah. Okay. It's kind of crazy. People have reached out being like, yo, let me help. Let's get this $1 billion. I'm just pissed. You know, like I'm like, I don't have enough Bitcoin. My company doesn't have enough Bitcoin. Like I just want more Bitcoin. Michael Saylor's buying it all up. And so like, if we're feeling the crunch, then they're the sat squeeze, then like, imagine all these like Fortune 500 companies who have hundreds of times more money than we do. Like, right. They've got to be feeling the squeeze. So, I want more Satoshis.
I hear that, man.
Just putting, you know, the whole idea of like manifesting stuff and like putting it out into the ether. Uh-huh. Or into the universe is probably the better term for
it. Yeah. We got to take that term back, man. We got to take that back.
Exactly. Putting it into the Satoshiverse. Just putting it out there. I'm just like, I want to buy $1 billion of Bitcoin right now, and I need it. So
I know, because
don't we all? Don't we all?
You can feel it all coming, man. Like, I don't know, this 50K Bitcoin thing, it's just like sitting around here. I feel like it's just an accumulation zone for all of these big companies. And they're just like champing at the bit to try to get in now. And I'm sure there's all this legal stuff that they've got to go through, and they're going through right now. I literally think there's hundreds of companies doing this right now.
Oh yeah. At least,
right?
In the US, there's 100 companies. It's like internationally, that's, then we're not even gonna be able to track it, right? Like,
yeah,
it's kind of wild. Like any intelligent CFO or CEO all around the world now has access to the same thing. And everybody saw the Michael Saylor, webinar. Like, that was the beauty of it. It's just like, you have this incredible thing that we all saw, we all loved, right? In the Bitcoin space, and everybody all around the world had access to it. Like, yeah. those are the kind of things that were only in like back, channel, like, boardrooms in Wall Street for things like that. And Michael Saylor just posts it everywhere on youtube.com, like, for everybody. And it's just like, it's game over. You know, it's like, the people that don't understand see it. And over the next year, you're just going to see one after another company saying, their balance sheet comes out and it says exactly how much Bitcoin, another one comes out. And it's just like every single one. But companies bigger 1%. Than Tesla. Like, companies,
they've got
1%.
We've got to get 5%. Now we got to get 10%. You know,
exactly.
There's no reason to hold any other like treasury reserve asset at this point.
No,
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So this is the question that's on everybody's mind, right? And I've talked to Preston Pish about it quite a bit. Like, is this escape velocity? I mean, is it the move that Saylor's making, right, is just so bold, it's so brazen, like, he just keeps doing it, and he's so far ahead of everyone, he's got this big head start. And yes, he published everything, which is, obviously in his interest too, to pump his bags, but he's got almost $100,000 Bitcoin in MicroStrategy plus whatever his stack is at now. I feel like he's gonna do this one more time before, maybe before the second quarter's out or something. And he's just throwing it out there. Like, look, guys, I'm going to eat all this up. You guys got to get moving.
Yeah. He warned everybody. Like, he's like, this is what I'm going to do. And he's done it. It's like Babe Ruth pointing to left field. I'm about to go get all of this Bitcoin, whether you guys are going to join me or not. Like, I'm getting it. And he sees it clear as day. He's like a principles first preacher. Like, he's not even really talking about the price. Like, he's talking about, like, this is why this works, right? And like, people are gonna listen to him. I mean, we sound, probably a little crazy to most people over the last, like, 6-7 years, but you have a little rocket scientist that has been running one of the biggest companies, in the US, many parts of the world. It comes out and it's just like, look, these are the principles, this is why this works. And then he goes and convinces like Elon in like one conversation. And then it's like, how many other people are like, behind the scenes is he convincing that this is the inevitable future, and that it does not like make financial sense not to have Bitcoin on your balance sheet. And if you look at like, you're seeing all these companies like Square and MicroStrategy, and like, they're not, you don't even have to be bullish Bitcoin. You have to literally, like, it's almost like, if you look at, you know, the terms of like what a good CEO's job is or a good CFO's job is, it's like they have to fulfill the fiduciary responsibility to their companies. Like that's their job, mm-hmm. right? Like,
yeah, right.
And so if you have all these other companies that have made the easy decision to just go buy Bitcoin, an asset that is available to everybody, they've given you the tax playbook, the accounting playbook, everything you possibly need to go do it, and you don't do it, like, right. and you're competing against these companies, like right. you will get fired. So right. it just has this like perfect incentive loop to it, where it's like, you have to buy Bitcoin as a CFO. Like you're not gonna have a choice. So imagine competing against Square, imagine competing against, like any financial product, like imagine competing at MicroStrategy and their Bitcoin holdings are like quadrupling in a few months. Like they now have more buying power. They now have more market power than you. And you can't, like, you will get left behind if you don't have it. So right, it's just right. this perfect forcing function outside of retail that is just, it's all going to just compound, right? The institutions yeah. are going to drive retail. The retail is going to drive institutions. Yeah. It's perfect. So perfect.
And these guys are coming in for the most part, right? I mean, definitely Saylor is with a completely different understanding than the, you know, bigger investors, the whales that were buying in 2017, because that was all fiat speculation. Like they were trying to make fiat gains for the most part, right? And they were cashed out at the top and we had another 85, 90% drop. If these guys are even half of these companies, and yeah, it's going to be tempting to, you know, convert back to the dollar. If the dollar hasn't hyperinflated by then, and remember like Michael Burry talking about this, about hyperinflation on a Twitter thread recently, like earlier this week, I think. And he made the point that, or I think he was, you know, just citing a point that was made by somebody else, that in Weimar Republic, like the currency was the strongest currency in the world right up until the hyperinflation started. So you might be tempted, you know, if you see a big run up to, you know, 5x or whatever, 10x from here, to cash back into dollars because it looks like it's really still really strong. And you just don't believe it's going to happen, right? There's going to be CFOs out there and CEOs out there that just like can't see this happening, can't like envision a collapse of the US dollar. That's just inconceivable to a lot of people, I think, especially who are entrenched, you know, in corporate America.
Yeah. And we've all done it, right? We've all like seen the run up. We get really excited. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I've done it. I've sold Bitcoin before and I hated myself when I look back on it. And it came from like not understanding it. Like now I will never sell Bitcoin again. I don't see a future where like I hope to never be in a position where I have to sell my Bitcoin, you know, like until maybe a hyper Bitcoinization future. And, you know, I have to go spend my Bitcoin and on different things, but you know, I don't, I ever want to sell my Bitcoin. And I think once you start to see the world like that, where it's like, you're so lucky to have gotten into Bitcoin when you got into it. And, you know, before it like mass inflation or, you know, hopefully not, but hyperinflation and it's just like, it just seems inevitable. So yeah, I think CFOs will see that there's probably plenty that will take gains from it. But then I think the Squares of the world, the MicroStrategy of the world, they'll just hold like forever, right? Like they have no reason to sell unless they absolutely needed but it's a power position to be able to hold that on your balance sheet.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, MicroStrategy could become one of the most powerful companies, probably will become one of the most powerful companies in the world in 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, this is just such a massive bet. And you can imagine like, you know, they got it. I think their average buy-in right now is like $23,000 or something, Saylor said. And you can imagine like, you know, Apple with its massive hoard of cash, like 190. Being like, all right, we're going to put in 1%. We're going to play a conservative. But then MicroStrategy like just ends up having more Bitcoin than Apple because Apple played it so conservatively. Right. And they're scooping up, you know, $2 million Bitcoin or something like that. And it's just, I mean, you know, it could be a massive flippening of this company just like becoming the largest in the world. You could see it happening. There is a path for that happening. I don't think Elon's going to let it happen, but
I'd love to be a fly on the wall. Like just, if I was a CFO of Apple, and I was like, I'm like looking at my balance sheet, I have like last I checked, it was like $190 billion in cash.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you know, inflation rate, is skyrocketing. Let's see, who's the Apple CFO? Luca Maestri. So if I'm Luca Maestri and I'm like looking at like my balance sheet and I've got like hyperinflation or just say inflation, let's be fair. It's like, why would I not have Bitcoin? And once you start to look at it, like I'm sure he has people that are like looking at buying Bitcoin and they're like, oh my God, okay, let's just do 5% or let's just do 10%. And then they're like, wait a second, you can't even buy 5%. He can't go buy $5 billion of Bitcoin. Like there's not that much liquidity. I don't think there's like that much liquidity in the market right now that they say like, I want $5 billion of Bitcoin just like tomorrow, right? You'd have to like ease into it and convince people to sell. And who's selling, right? Like
there are people selling, obviously. I mean, Michael Saylor just bought $1 billion of the Bitcoin at $52,000. So there's people selling. Who are these people? Like, what are they doing? I don't get it. Are they playing some game? They think they can like control the market now. The coins are just flying off exchanges. I mean, they're being taken into cold storage. We're down to like 2.3 million coins on exchanges available to buy. So that was from a peak of 3 million. I don't know, man. I just, at some point the squeeze is going to happen again. I don't know who's selling right now, but they are. There's the other thing though, like the phenomenon. I'm just trying to get my head around this, you know, and like I've learned a bit more about how since working at Swan about how like OTC desks work and how all of this, you know, trading just like infrastructure works behind the scenes. And if there's a bunch of OTC stuff going on, it doesn't necessarily show up into the spot price for a while, right? Because they're not like necessarily taking Bitcoin off of the exchanges, the markets themselves at the spot price. So that can kind of hide until that demand is sort of, you know, pushed, forced out onto the spot market. So maybe that's what's happening now. Seems like it.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting. And it's all gonna be public too. Like all the companies that Saylor was talking to. I mean, these are all public companies, so it's all gonna be out there. And I think that's one of the cool things about this. Like I have a hard time getting excited about like billionaires buying Bitcoin. Like sure, like, you know, we pump it on our Twitter. It's like fun content. It's like, you know, it's bullish to see like Elon and stuff like that. But I'm more about like financial inclusivity and you know, having equal access to it. But the companies is interesting because it's like, you know, there's like transparency and, you know, there's bad parts of corporations and the protections and stuff like that for different companies. But like, there's also transparency, like, you know, exactly how much these companies are holding. And there's a certain like truth in that I really like, that I think it's bullish. It's exciting. And these companies are representing, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees, like many of them are. And so to see companies that have strong financial holdings in Bitcoin is like, I think, net good for everybody. Even more like I'm way more bullish about like companies holding, you know, even than like, you know, high net worth individuals that already have, you know, all the money in the world that you're going to have like no, insights into them holding. And so, yes, like Bitcoin is about the self-sovereign individual, but it also is, it shows kind of the beauty of it is that it's available for everybody, every company, every country, anybody can hold Bitcoin. And like when the companies start to come in and the countries start to come in, like that kind of shows the power of Bitcoin, that anybody, any organization can own it. And that's super powerful. It's really cool just to see it play out.
It's incredibly powerful. It's the first time that this has ever happened in the history of the world, right? I mean, it's an absolute, you know, once in a species revolution, which is hard to contemplate. But, you know, money is like a, you know, you can call it a discovery or a technology, but it's kind of like it's an emergent phenomenon. Like we just sort of like have to discover it. It's like forced upon you because of the problems of barter, right? So it's like, it's going to be discovered at some point because it's so necessary. We haven't had any other options besides gold, right? I mean, ultimately, like there's been a lot of other things used, but the market has, you know, converged on gold over and over and over again throughout history. And even now, like, you know, these central banks are holding gold, you know, China, Russia, they're both buying gold for their central banks, right? So that ultimately is still the money. Even though the currencies that we use to, like, you know, everyday medium of exchange aren't really tied to it anymore. So yeah, now we have this thing that's like both a final settlement layer, but also can be a medium of exchange and a self-sovereign one. There will be currencies, I'm sure, built on top of it that, you know, are backed by Bitcoin, but are sovereign or held by nations. But yeah, it's anyone can get to it, and any, like, it democratizes that final settlement completely. It's revolutionary. It's for individuals and freedom and privacy, and it's all of those levels, besides just the fact that, you know, it's incredible to watch these massive corporations and governments sort of open their eyes to what we've been looking at for all these years.
Yep, absolutely.
It's crazy. When did you get into Bitcoin?
I first learned about Bitcoin in 2013. Okay. And
that's pretty OG.
I feel like I got it. I wish I had more money when I learned about it. I think we all do did, but you know, I was like, I was putting all my money into my company at the time, and I was like, you know, just bootstrapping. I was paying myself like $30K a year, as much as I could, to like live in New York, crashing on couches and stuff. But I remember I was crashing on couches, and I bump into this guy at a bar, and this guy had just learned about Bitcoin. And actually, many people actually probably know him, Ryan Shay, founder of Blockstack.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And they're doing a lot of cool things on Second Layer right now with stacks and some fun stuff there. So yep. I meet Ryan, and he had just gotten the Bitcoin bug, and he's telling me all about it. And I had been building a company called Cosmic, and Cosmic's whole mission our mission was to democratize commerce. We wanted to give everyone in the world the ability to buy and sell anywhere. And we were building these really innovative, like backend pipes, essentially. So we would hook into the backends of merchants, and then we would create this abstraction layer that would let them sell their products anywhere. So if you're, let's just say Walmart, you're really good at selling on walmart.com, Target, really good at selling target.com. But anytime you want to sell anywhere else, any other countries or anything, it's really difficult to abstract all those layers of commerce, inventory, pricing, product information, everything.
Right, right.
So we created this abstraction layer. And so meanwhile, I'm hooking into all these different payment gateways and having an absolute mess. And I've been in payment since I was like 16, you know, really trying to like move money all around the internet, all over the world. And everywhere I would get blocked. I'd have like 20%. Like if I was like starting a business and I was like 16, 17, and I would have like a risky, flag on my name because I was like moving money from like me to Ukraine to pay engineers, or me to Bangladesh to pay support staff or whatever. And so I've been like a kid of the internet, right? Like I've been trying to move money around the world since I found the internet started building on the internet. Right. So I had all these frustrations with like all the middlemen, all the pipes, everything was so broken. If you understand payments, you saw Bitcoin and you're like, oh my God, this thing solves everything. So we talk about Bitcoin for like 2 hours that night, and I am just like locked in, engaged, like, oh my God, this is the future. This is the inevitable future. I was like, you're telling me that there is a currency out there that anybody with an internet connection can own, move, trade, sell, buy anything. I was like, this is everything that I was dreaming of, native to a currency. And, yeah. You know, playing off like the last like 5-6 years of building in payments, like I was just hooked like day one. And I was like, this is the inevitable future. I need to learn everything about it. Bought my first Bitcoin, you know, 2013. Coinbase was like the only thing out there. Glad I didn't buy on like Mt. Gox or anything like that. But basically, like, you know, got my first Bitcoin. Clearly wish I got more. I know that's probably bad OPSEC, but I'm okay saying I got one Bitcoin. at least. And so like, yeah, basically fast forward, I was like, okay, I need to figure out a way to incorporate it into our business model because this is the inevitable future. So I ended up going to all of our merchants and I said, hey, like Target, like Macy's, Best Buy, you know, we're working with you with like 99 different payment gateways. Why don't you just add Bitcoin? This is like an incredible thing. Like anybody around the world can pay you. If you're Target, if you're Best Buy, like anybody can go pay you in this immutable currency. You know, you're used to paying all these payment processors 3.5% minimum, you know, or let's just say 1.5% minimum to the payment processors. And then you have all these other middlemen with security and everything, merchant acquiring banks, Visa, MasterCard, everybody. I'm like, why, if someone wants to pay you in this currency and you can pay 0.01% in fees or 1% in fees or whatever, why not pay that as opposed to 1.5% absolute minimum? So all these merchants were like, okay, we're not going to accept it. We're not interested. We don't know what we would do with remittance networks. We'd have to go set up like a treasury strategy. And to be fair, that is very complicated. I mean, this is 2013, right? So
yeah, right.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, in hindsight, setting up like a remittance network would have been a really good business back then, but I didn't have that foresight. So I did not do that. But basically, like, they would all need remittance networks set up for their treasury. And then on the other side, they were like, consumers don't have it. So yeah. Like, and the consumers that had it didn't want to pay with it because number go up technology. So yeah. Basically, like, that was like my first foray in seeing where Bitcoin, I think, was going to be adopted versus where I think a lot of people thought it was going to be adopted. You know, the BitPays of the world came out and everybody thought, oh my God, Bitcoin payments is the future. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't think that's not how you bring Bitcoin to a billion people. And right. So the first wave, I think, that came after it was like, you know, the investing. It was like, how do you make Bitcoin more accessible to people through to investors? But in the back of my head, I'm sending, you know, my Coinbase link to all these, you know, friends and family and just saying like, hey, this is really interesting. Do your research and consider it. Yeah. You know, like, I was telling them what I believed. Like, I was like, I've never told anybody to buy Bitcoin. I know that sounds crazy, but never told anyone to buy Bitcoin. But I've always said, do your research and then consider it. So people just like didn't get it. They weren't investing in it. And so it's because most people are not investors. So
true.
You have to make it easy. So I, you know, love what Swan's doing to make it easier to, like, you know, teach people about DCA, dollar cost averaging. Yeah. It makes it easier for people to become investors. Robinhood, you know, Public, these sort of apps like that made investing in stocks way easier. And before, most people would have never set up a Fidelity or E-Trade account, but because Robinhood was so much easier, more fun, and more like approachable. So, yep. I mean, that's what I love about Swan, right? Like, it makes it easier for the average person to come into this space and treat it almost like a subscription to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And that's way easier. It's like Netflix for Bitcoin. You guys can steal that.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, likewise with Lolly, you know, this is another way to bring people to Bitcoin, and it's even more top of the funnel than what Swan is doing, right? So it's going to be, and probably has been already, like, people's first experience with Bitcoin. You know, I don't know how many users you guys have, but I know it's a lot, and I know that I would say, I don't know, it's probably smaller, right? But it's a growing percentage of them. This is their first touch with Bitcoin.
Yeah, we have a lot. When we first started, it was like Bitcoin maximalists.
Bitcoiners,
like, I want as much Bitcoin as possible. Like, I have to go buy groceries. I have to go buy, you know, stuff online. And we've totally broken outside of that. And yep. And so, like, clearly, like, love all the Bitcoin maxis out there. but the most bullish moment was when we started to see trends that it was like we were way more than that, because you're not gonna we're never going to bring Bitcoin to a billion people or 7 billion people, or 7.9 billion people. If we don't, you know, break outside of the Bitcoin maximalist, you have to reach new people. So, shopping is a great way to do that, because, like, you know, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, not everybody invests, but everybody shops. Like, everybody who's like, I mean, if you're over the age of 13, you have probably bought something at some point in your life, whether cash, credit card, debit card, whatever. Like, it's just part of being, you know, a human being, right? Staying alive, yeah. You buy stuff, you know, very obvious, right? So if you can attach shopping and rewards, which I think almost everybody is familiar with or has gotten rewards at some point in their life, if you have a debit card, if you have a credit card, if we can attach rewards to something as intuitive as, you know, like, you know, a currency that is going up over time, yeah, it's a no-brainer. So when we were ultimately with our last company, we were bought by Rakuten, which is the biggest cashback company in the U.S., many parts of the world. And we saw this incredible, like, rabid user that was just like obsessed with their cash back. They love getting rewards. They love maxing out their rewards. And so we had met all these merchants over the, like, 3,000, 4,000 merchants over the 7 years that we had built this company, Cosmic.
This is Cosmic. Okay.
Yeah. And so, and we'd also made them hundreds of millions of dollars with all these different, you know, over those years. So I'm like, well, what am I going to bring to Bitcoin? Right. Like, I think that's the thing that everyone has to, should be thinking about. Like, and that's what's so beautiful about Twitter is like everybody brings Bitcoin Twitter. Everybody brings something. Everyone says like, you know, there's a lot of Bitcoin maximalists out there that have made more money than they ever need. Right. But everybody brings something to the space. It's like, whether you're tweeting out memes, whether you're shit posting, whether you're, you know, starting podcasts, whether you're building Swan or Lolly or whatever, like, you know, everybody brings something to Bitcoin. So I was like, what is my contribution to bring Bitcoin to more people? And I was like, I know cash back. I know rewards better than anybody in the world. And like, I know more merchants. I have all these merchant relationships. And I was like, nobody has these merchants. BitPay didn't have them. Like, no, nobody had these top merchants, the same merchants that, that, you know, Saylor's going and preaching to, you know, many years later. You know, I was like, I know all these merchants. I've made them money. They trust me. And in the centralized world, trust is extremely important. You know, there's a reason why we're building, you know, in the Bitcoin space for this like trustless economy, trustless world. But for now, it is about relationships, and these merchants trust me, and because I've made them lots of money. So I went to them and I was like, look, you don't have to believe in Bitcoin. That's fine. Just believe in me. Know that like I believe in this thing and that I'm going to go make you money. And we have all of these incredible people that want Bitcoin more than cash. That's all you have to know. And these are great customers. They're great people, and they're going to pay you the same, you know, for your services, for your products. And so, yeah, we launched 3 years ago, and it's just been a rocket ship.
I can't believe it's been 3 years, man. Wow.
It hasn't even been 3 years. It's actually been almost 3 years, but yeah, it's like 2 years, 11 months. We'll celebrate our 3 year anniversary very soon. But yeah, we started, I think, March 2018. And yeah, we built a prototype. I went, did my thing, knocked on every merchant's door. I tried to get as many as possible. We got 500 to start. And then now we're up to over 1,000 merchants. And yeah, we just keep bringing them on board. We're actually launching a massive new merchant tomorrow, which I'll share. That'll be Friday, February 26th. And yeah, I'm just like pumped. I mean, if everybody could hear the conversations I've had from 3 years ago to now with these merchants, it's crazy. Like, I literally, 3 years ago, these merchants that didn't come on board, like the other 500 that I pitched that didn't come on board, that are now on board, they were like, I don't know about Bitcoin. It seems like a scam, you know, seems like, you know, just like weird, or, you know, people are like, you know, they were like, I don't know if we want to associate our brand with it. And then I get all their competitors on board. I build all these case studies, and I'm like, okay, you can get left behind, or you can come, you know, join us. And so we've gotten like, you know, all these merchants, all their competitors, everybody on board. And now I've got merchants that are like, that I've sent the Bitcoin standard to over the years. And they're coming back to me and being like, you were right. Like, you know, I bought Bitcoin when you told me to go research it and stuff like that. And now we've got all these Bitcoiners internally at these massive companies that are inside of these companies selling internally. And like, now they're giving us higher rates than Rakuten. They're giving us higher rates than our competitors because they're Bitcoiners. So it's fun, man. It's fun. And like, that's like the part of our world that people don't see. And, but it's like, we are very much as we are top of funnel, bringing new Bitcoiners into this world. We're also bringing merchants into this world, and people don't like see that, but it's an exciting part. We'll, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, tell the story in a more formal fashion, but it's fun. It's so fun,
man. It that's amazing to hear. And that just is so true about Bitcoin, that there were sort of, it's the ultimate Trojan horse on every level, because each individual Bitcoiner is incepting, you know, their little corners of the world, their little corners of the economy. And, you know, there's Bitcoiners in Congress, there's Bitcoiners in Goldman Sachs, there's Bitcoiners probably at the Fed. Like, you know, it's just infiltrating every little thing in just this organic way. It's amazing.
Because everybody can own it. It's crazy. Yeah. It's not like, it's not, you know, it's not some crazy thing. It's like everybody that has an internet connection can own this asset, and you can fight it all you want. But like, everybody can own it. And like, if you don't, you look stupider and stupider every single day, that you don't, you know, look into the principles, do your research, like make a decision for yourself, you know? And like, we're starting to, it's all starting to play out. Everything that we've dreamed is starting to play out, and it's fun. And we're just, we're going to get rewarded. The people that believe in it are going to get rewarded. Newcomers, everybody.
Yeah. It's amazing to watch. It's, this year is already, I cannot see a near future where this thing just doesn't go completely nuts, like beyond even what Bitcoiners are thinking. And like, I understand, like, look, I keep getting talked to by, like, I'm getting more bullish than everybody. And even my bullish friends who, you know, like kind of brought me along on this path, like Gigi, super hype, like hyper bullish, you know, like we've done podcasts in the past, like literally in the title, it's like hyper bullishness or whatever. And now he's like super conservative because he doesn't think hyper Bitcoinization is going to come until 2028. And so, you know, it just feels like everything is lined up so perfectly to bring that 2028 forward so much. The macro environment, the Sailor thing, just really like blowing it up on the scene. CNBC is talking about Bitcoin every day. We know more corporations are having to like really push to adopt Bitcoin much faster now. And it's just, it feels like that has, it, like we're at that moment where it's just taking off and it's not going to look back. And you know, it's going to be different this time. And you always want to be like, look, you want to be very cautious about saying stuff like that, you know, that's going to be different this time, but it certainly feels a hell of a lot different.
I don't even recognize the space from 3 years ago. You know, 2017, it's totally different.
Completely.
Like, just look around. Like, yeah. I was like, no, nobody. 2017 was like all like, I mean, I look back, it's like, what was even there that's here now?
Yeah. Even all the education stuff. Like all the podcasts that we like, all the big podcasts in the space started like at the end of 2017, toward the end of 2017.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so much education out there. Just so many conversations that you can draw from, books, you know, dozens and dozens of books just on Bitcoin now. Insane essays. Yeah. The memes,
the memes that have come out over the last 3 years. Unreal. I mean, laser Bitcoiners. Eyes. Like one of the greatest Bitcoin memes in the history of Bitcoin. And that, it's
that
so funny.
Spread like so Bitcoin, fast. That was like 24 hours.
So you know? Good.
It was like 24 hours. Everyone had laser eyes.
Yeah. It's the mimetic energy right now. Like I think it's kind of funny. Bitcoin has no central force, right? Like, and you can't, I think about this a lot with like programming. I'll back up a little bit. Like with programming languages or something like that, you have to like, you really have to have like a core crew that is like, you know, even for like a, you know, for something decentralized, like a computer programming language or I guess Bitcoin Core is a good example too. You have to have like a core crew that is like, you know, disseminating, you know, the technology and getting it out there, and then companies start to adopt it. And with like, the mimetic energy right now in the Bitcoin space is just so powerful. It's like, it's like there's no central person, there's no group, there's no like central like mimetic, you know, think tank or anything like that. It's just there's so many Bitcoiners and like these people could be making memes for anything. And still no other coin, nothing has as good of memes as Bitcoin. And it's like, at some point I'm like, dude, if I was like, sometimes I think about like attack vectors, and I think like if I was running some like shitcoin, I'm like, well, what would I do? I'd probably get really fucking good at making memes and just be the best. Like Chainlink is probably a good example of like, they make a ton of memes, but they're all sort of like vapid. Like there's nothing behind them.
They're like professional.
They're very professional. Memes. Right. Yeah. Corporate memes. That's good.
Corporate memes. I mean, the only competitor is Dogecoin, right? Which is in of itself a meme coin. And they're still, the believers are still, you know, I mean, those are getting a little bit stale, I think, but Elon Musk is kind of inspiring a new generation.
That's a good point. Memes are native to, I guess, Dogecoin. So it does have, I guess, maybe a little bit of a leg up there. So, no pun intended.
Yeah, but the new stuff, right? There's not like a bunch of new Dogecoins, you know, Doge memes coming out. Like it's all migrating to Bitcoin. Everything's migrating to Bitcoin.
Everything.
It brings the best memers, brings the best coders, brings the best entrepreneurs. You know, it's just inspiring everybody. It's crazy. I mean, I just have conversations like this every day. It's like I'm a podcaster, and I like every conversation now, even Swansea Live, I'm just like losing words. I'm just like, I don't know what to say anymore.
Yeah. As a podcaster, I'm speechless.
Yeah. I am speechless. Like I talk a lot. And I
this is my job, but I'm
anymore.
Speechless.
It's crazy. So you have a really interesting past, man. Like it sounds like you've been like an entrepreneur since high school. Tell me what is it like about you? I mean, it seems just innate to you. When did this start? Like, and it seems like just a passion that like entrepreneurship is hard. Running a company is hard. starting a company is freaking hard. And you have to be a certain kind of person. So like, just tell me about it. Like, what is it about Alex Edelman that just like from the very beginning has made you want to be a business builder?
I wish I knew, to be honest. I literally couldn't do anything else. So maybe that's part of it. I have this, the way that my brain works is I see something and I'm like, this is how the world should be. Mm-hmm. And it has to be like that. And so anything that deters from that is just, it doesn't, it's like, I need it to look this way and I want the world to look this way and anything else doesn't make sense. And I'm totally like, it sounds like a very like dogmatic approach to life, but it actually is like I've heard the term like reality distortion field of like,
right.
This is how the world should be.
It sounds like Steve Jobs, right? He just,
I'm not trying to say I'm Steve Jobs, but
it sounds like that. I mean, it's that approach because he literally would not compromise on his vision ever.
You know, yeah. And I feel that. And I felt that since I was like a child. And it was like, you know, coming down to like, I mean, if I was like making art, or if I was like, you know, building Legos or whatever it was, like, I like don't know how to describe it, but I can like see exactly what it's going to look like, exactly what I'm going to build. And it's like, okay, now I just have to figure out the steps to get there. Yeah. And I've tried working for people. I've tried building for other people's visions, but I haven't, there's been few people that I've met throughout my life that I could ever see myself like working for that mm-hmm. share that vision. Because as soon as you like work for somebody, you basically have to build their vision. And if I've worked for enough people that I've seen their vision not go the way that is the future. And I do think I have a pretty good history of predicting the future that, and not just the future. Like there's plenty of people who can predict the future. I think there's very few people that can like predict how to get to that future.
Sure.
And that's a huge distinction. So yeah, I mean, I'm just like, I'm not trying to brag, but I've been right about a lot of things on the, like that throughout my last, like, or most of my life as like an adult and as a kid. And so like I started building video games when I was like 12, like
nice.
I saw like, you know, early signs of like, you know, game makers, what I used to like build on, kind of like trick myself into programming. And so like, yeah. I was like out there, like, you know, shilling my games to like friends at recess and like selling games, you know.
What did you build your games with? Like,
so there was this program out there called Game Maker. And okay. I would like rip it off of probably illegal, but statute of limitations, I'm probably fine. But like, I used to rip Game Maker, a few other systems out there that you could like go build games. And basically you had to, if you wanted to get really good at them, you had to program them on top of it. But they had basically this like GUI where you could go build video games. And so I was like, I want to go build video games that like my friends like, and that that I want to play, because I was out there like playing like pinball on like MS-DOS and stuff. So I'm like, I want to go build my own games and my own storylines and create my own worlds and all that sort of stuff. So that's like my first foray. That's kind of how I like learned about, you know, programming and all that sort of stuff. And then I got to a point when I was like 16, where I was like, okay, like I was like working in restaurants, cause I love food. I absolutely love food. I'm obsessed. Like cooking everything, creating. And so I was working in restaurants.
You gotta make it like you want it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm like cooking is like my dad like didn't believe in like me having like an internet job. He was like, you know, however you're making money, that's great, whatever. But you also have to have like a quote unquote real job. So I was like working in restaurants, and I was also like, you know, programming and building websites on the side. And, you know, I got to this point where I was like, I don't really love programming. I love like design. Mm-hmm. I love building, and I love building like teams and hiring. And like, I just got to this point where I was like, I need to just hire people who are like way more brilliant than I am, that can like go build all the cool things that I wanted to envision in the world. So I start going all around the world, just finding like .NET engineers, because like Remington Gun Company was like a client, and like they like needed some like backend system for like, you know, gun education or something like that. So I like went out there and I like found all these like .NET engineers all over the world. And I was like, okay, I got to go pay them. And so that was like my first experience in like building a team, you know, moving money all around the world, and just like figuring it out as I go. And so I was building like websites and then backend systems throughout like college. And then in college, I was like, you know, I've basically been running like a, you know, software consultancy business. Yeah. And I was studying economics at the time. And I only because I didn't get into the undergrad business school, I was probably too busy, like too busy
building
like
businesses.
Building businesses and having fun. And I guess they didn't respect that. But you know, whatever. I like being the underdog. So I ended up like accidentally falling in love with economics. And if I didn't, I look back, if I went to business, you know, undergrad school, I feel like I would have learned a lot of like soft skills that I already had, you know, finance, yeah, accounting, like I already learned a lot of that stuff. Probably could be better at that. But I started to like take these econ classes, and I'm like, oh my God, this is cool. This is how the world works. And I have always had this like deep fascination with like, not just like how, you know, things work on my local level. I'm like, I want to know how like the world works. How does like international business works? How does finance work internationally? So I started to zoom out a lot during those years, and I was studying microfinance initiatives, largely the Grameen Bank and everything they were doing in Bangladesh. Yeah. And they had some very interesting early studies where they would give the poorest woman in every village in Bangladesh, yeah, a cell phone. And yep, they started to see like, what were the net effects of giving these people, a cell phone, this enablement, this like communication layer that they could have, that they could then communicate with the other poorest people in these different villages. And so by giving them a cell phone, giving them access to the internet, the trickle up economics that occurred from that enablement was so inspiring to me. And that was like, okay,
me too.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And so I'm like, I have to do this. I was already like long internet at that point, right? Like being a kid of the internet, super long internet. So I'm like, I want to enable people. I want to enable the poorest people. I want to enable everybody to have access to the same things that I had access to. Like, I was so lucky that my parents got a computer for like our family. And like, we were not wealthy by any means, but they got a computer and I had access to the internet, even if it was dial up when, you know, a lot of my friends had like broadband, high speed internet, but that we got a computer. And I like, because I had access to it, I have, you know, built my own success and my own, you know, tools. And I'm just like, well, why should some 12-year-old kid in Bangladesh not have the same access that I had when I was 12 years old? Right. To go build games and build the future that I wanted to live in. And so my like life mission, I was like, okay, well, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I'm going to democratize commerce. I'm going to give everybody in the world equal access to the things that I was so fortunate to have access to. And that's what I want to do with my life. So yeah. I started to look at like, what does that look like in a practical nature? What does that look like in technology? And I was told like early on, like, you should never focus, or you just, it's sort of a losing battle to like be the best at one thing, because that's a really hard thing, right? Like, yeah, you know, yeah. I can never be the best at basketball. I can never be the best wrestler. I can never be, you know, the best, like of one thing. And I think that's a very tough reality, because I am like, I have an obsessive personality. I like want to be the best at everything I do. And it's really fucking hard to be the best at any one thing. So
really fucking hard.
Yeah. And so like maybe one day I would love to be the best at something, and I'll try to pick up what that thing is, but I haven't found it yet. But basically the advice that I was given is like, be the best at two things together, be the best at three things mm-hmm. together. And mm-hmm. that's a way more achievable thing. So mm-hmm. I learned that framework at like an early age, and I was like, okay, I'm pretty good. Like like I have a pretty good understanding of economics, not the best at it. I'll never be the best economist. I'm really good at building technology, like really good at hiring. Like that was something I knew early on. I was like, I can convince almost anyone in the world to join me to build almost anything. And I found that like at a young age. I was like 16 convincing like 50-year-old .NET engineers to like leave their jobs and come join me. Like, and I was okay. That's amazing. Like I can sell, even though I would never consider myself a salesman, I can sell. And so I'm like, what? And I also like got really good with like designing software, building art. Like I knew enough about technology to be dangerous, about like architecture and stuff like that. So I like coupled all these things and I was like, okay, I'm going to go build something that democratizes commerce and with a practical application. And so what I came up with was Cosmic. It was the universal card as a service. It was the pipes of commerce to give everybody in the world the ability to buy, sell anywhere. And that was like, I mean, my, you know, breakout moment that gave me the flexibility and the viewpoints or the perspective to see Bitcoin, understand it from like day one, and then be like, okay, this is the future. Now I have to think of what part am I going to play to be a part of that future. And, you know, I think like we all did, like we all chose to get it active. We didn't just sit back. We didn't just invest in it. We didn't just, you know, shill it to friends. We were like, okay, let's go build something that's going to advance it and not just bring it to the five people we're closest with. Let's go bring it to like a million people. Let's go bring it to 100 million people. And that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. So here we are.
God. Yeah. And you just can't help it. Like it's just consumes like every spare brain cycle when you figure out the potential to change the world, that this thing actually change the world from the ground up. All right, so I've got to ask you about economics. How has Bitcoin changed your college-educated view of economics? Like, let's put aside like the macroeconomic thing, you know, where like the interactions of governments and large businesses and kind of that strategy stuff, but like just the way money works and kind of microeconomics, has it changed your view? I assume you got like a Keynesian economic education.
Yeah, very, very much so. lot of Keynesians. And I felt like it was kind of perfect. Like I was never a really good student. I never like, you know, got like great grades. I never really cared that I really had to care about like a subject. And I had to agree with what I was learning. And I actually remember fighting a lot in like my econ classes because I was like, you're building these models for how the world, you know, works, quote unquote works. And I'm like, but the models are like, you know, 51% accurate or 60% accurate. And it didn't take into account behavioral economics. It didn't take into account, you know, opposing viewpoints of like, you know, sound money, you know, principles and there was just a lot of like irrational thinking in both a good way and a bad way. Right. Like, but I just was like very, I kind of thought like going into econ that everything, like the way that the world worked was just like perfect. It was like, you know, I had my dollar, that dollar equaled this dollar. The Fed had like, I just assumed like the Fed was smarter than
right.
Like I realized. And I just
think they assumed that too.
Yeah. And I just assumed that like, I guess I made a lot of assumptions. And I think as much as I disagreed with the teachings of my econ professors, I actually felt like I learned enough to be dangerous. And my natural inclination is to question absolutely everything. And I question Bitcoin every day and I'm looking for something better. And I think that might be where I differ from some people in the Bitcoin space that are like true, you know, true maxis or whatever. Like I actually like question Bitcoin all the time and I'm always looking for something better. I'm all like, I want there to be something better than Bitcoin. I do like, you know, and that is like, you know, something different. I'm just like, show me something better than Bitcoin. And I haven't seen it yet, but back then, you know, kind of going back to,
do you think it'll just, I mean, cause this is programmable money, right? So it's not like some static thing, like maybe the better Bitcoin is just the Bitcoin 5 years from now, you know, or 10 years from now.
Totally. And maybe we can build a better Bitcoin on top of Bitcoin. Right. Maybe it's layer two solutions that are doing it. And like, if we didn't question Bitcoin, you know, maybe like, Lolly wouldn't exist. Maybe Lightning wouldn't exist. Like, we're building a lot of what we're doing, knowing that in order for our full vision to be achieved, yeah, Lightning needs to exist. Liquid needs to exist. Like, there's solutions that have to exist on top of Bitcoin in order to achieve the full thing that we want to achieve. And I guess we don't have to, we're not relying on it to be successful. But at the same time, if we want to live in the future that we believe that we're going to live in, like, certain things have to be built that are not built yet. Yeah. So, and I have full confidence that they will, but I guess my point is that I look at a lot of things very critically, very like pragmatically to try to understand them better. And so back in my econ classes, I was like, none of this, like, everything makes half amount of sense. And so I was like trying to fill in the gap. So I remember going like across the, I went to Chapel Hill. So I was like, I went across the street to Duke to go take courses because Dan Ariely, who is like, you know, basically after Kahneman, he was kind of, he had this like whole new wave of thinking in economics that all of my professors hated, right? Like all, his way of thinking of like behavioral economics is like way more pervasive throughout society than we actually believe. And all of these like 60% models are actually closer to like 50% or 40% or 30%. And they're like, when you factor in irrationality and human behavior, you actually are way less, we know way less than we think. And so my general thought was, I was like, if we're below 50% with these models, then like, what's the purpose of these models that are being, you know, created? And how do we judge monetary policy? How do we write good monetary policy? You know, how do we run federal balance sheet with fiduciary responsibility of that country? How do we do that, right? If we're building these models that are not accurate, like how is the Fed, you know, making sure that we don't go into hyperinflation? And so now I think like a lot of those beliefs that I wasn't smart enough or knowledgeable enough to articulate back then, now I see clear as day because a technology emerged that gave us an out. It gave us the ability to opt out, and it gave us this ability to hold an asset that has the same rules. Like literally 100% of the rules are the exact same, whether I'm in the United States or whether I'm in Bangladesh, whether I'm the Ukrainian government, whether I'm the richest person in the world or the poorest person in the world with an internet connection, I have the same exact rules. And that was what I was looking for. That was the question I had to all of my professors. I'm like, why is there not 100% accuracy in this, you know, world that we live in? We have the internet. Like, we have all these protocols. We have math, you know, like we're doing math. Like everybody knows what addition and subtraction, everybody knows what 1 + 1 is. And you could get into like, you know, some crazy stuff with math that we don't have to go to, but for the most part, 1 + 1 = 2 and everybody knows it. And so like, why is that not true with our money? And that like was what led me into sound money principles and gave me this sort of, I think, viewpoint that the world and the people that created the world that we live in were not right. And so kind of going back to, you know, reality distortion, I actually think that all Bitcoiners have a level of reality distortion in their brains because they are seeing the world that does not exist yet, but should and is the inevitable future. So, you know, if you have Bitcoin at this point in history, you have reality distortion, you know, field in your brain because literally you're saying like, you know, this is currency that makes so much sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to 99% of the world right now. And you are crazy. And the future belongs to those people that can see that future that feels inevitable at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. The tagline of this podcast is "Welcome to the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance." And I think that's like what we're, you know, that's the reality distortion. Cause it's something that, and to your point, right? Like Bitcoin, I wouldn't have learned about what money really is. And I had the same assumptions, and we've all grown up as like, you know, just default native Keynesians. That's just the way things were. Right. I mean, it's been several generations now. So it's just like, okay, this is how it works. This is how money works. And you know, I took some economics classes too, and it was like, you know, central banking is an innovation and allows us to more precisely, you know, control, the economy and prevent boom and bust cycles or like dampen them down. And it's just exactly the opposite. Like it's just exactly the opposite. Like it's removing the, like the magic of money. Like money just solves this. It's just like, it does it like with scalpel, like precision. And if you take it and put it in the hands of a few people and make all these models, you're just like starting to bludgeon with this giant like sledgehammer or something on these problems. And it just doesn't make any sense, but it's hubris, you know, it's hubris. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, we must be able to do something. If we study hard enough, if we think hard enough, if we write enough like super long books and, you know, listen to ourselves think and teach all these courses and stuff, then we're going to figure out how to do it better than just doing nothing.
You know? Exactly. You nailed it. It's actually like, I'm reminded, like before I started Lolly, I was reading some philosophy and I kind of stumbled across, I was like really thinking about, I mean, it was like the dawn of like fake news and like everybody was talking about, you know, truth and you know, David Hume, if you're ever like looking for an interesting read, reading some stuff by Hume, and, you know, he was around like 200 years ago and he was actually hated when he came out, like everybody hated him. And like, he, like his whole thing was humans are constantly seeking truth. And what is truth? And like, if you really sit down and try to define truth, there are very few things in the world that have elements of truth, like actual truth. There are certain principles in math that are like, you know, that are true, but in most like everyday life, like it's actually pretty hard to find truth. Like humans are constantly seeking it because it provides almost like calm and it gives us sort of this like stability or this stasis. I think in our daily lives, when we find truth, I think it's like a very difficult thing to find. And there's not like this thing that we interact with every single day, which is money, is not a truth. It's like $1, like we don't know how much it's worth. It changes every day. And when you look at Bitcoin, yes, it changes relative to the dollar, but like one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin, one Satoshi is one Satoshi. And it backs up and all the math works and everybody's tried to break it and they can't break it. And like, you know, TikTok next block, every single, like every single 10, you know, every 10 minutes, it just works. Right. And so if you believe in the principles of Hume of like, and now Hume's like one of the most popular philosophers, like, you know, many, many, many years later, you know, well after death. And now it's like what he was thinking is that humans are seeking truth, and you know, fake news comes out now and fake money comes out now and like money printer go burr and like all over the world and inflation and hyperinflation. And we're all like, wait a second, we're looking for the truth in money. And where is that truth? Bitcoin. So like everybody's looking around and like right now with all like, everyone's skeptical, right? It's like everybody's like freaking out. Like, what is true? Is it stonks? Is it cash? Yeah. Is it like nothing's real anymore? It's everything is just this like illusion. And now people have all like, it's like everyone has been given the red pill or the orange pill, however you want to say it. And like now you're like, oh my God, I'm looking for the truth. Just give me something to like ease my mind, because like everything right now is just fucking insane. Yeah. So you're like looking for that truth. And I look around and I'm like, the only thing I think that everybody could agree on is that there's like 21 million Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So show me something else that has more truth than Bitcoin.
It is. It's the truth. It's the only absolute truth besides like, I guess, laws of physics. And Saylor talks about this, like it preserves energy perfectly. So you put in monetary energy and it just saves it over time, perfectly over time. And it's like it can neither be created nor destroyed, right? It's just like, it's always 21 million. That's it.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know,
so good.
It's just, I mean, there's only so much energy in the world, and it's always constant. So it's amazing. It's so good. And it's just ingenious. Do you ever wonder like about Satoshi and like, obviously this brilliant mind who was some kind of a polymath, had a grasp, you know, like he was a generalist, right? Didn't wasn't a great coder, probably wasn't like really the best, like you said, the best at anything, but he was the best at like five things.
Yeah,
you know?
Good pullback, by the way. That,
yeah,
like,
right.
Satoshi might be the best example of that ever.
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't even made that connection yet. That's amazing. Yeah, Satoshi's like the best at five things.
Yeah, he was the best in the world at five things, right?
Yeah.
And just like, do you, even with that sort of like vision of like, we need this thing and here's how to pull it all together. And, you know, it's finally done after 30 years of trying to build money on the internet that couldn't be double spent. Do you think that they saw this? Like, was this in the vision? Like, could they have understood this? I don't know, man. You go back to like some of Hal Finney's early stuff and it seemed pretty prosaic. I don't know. It's fascinating to think, like, what was that experience like giving birth to Bitcoin? I mean, do you ever go back and think about that?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah. And actually, like, when I go back and think about it, I wonder, like, if we'll ever have, I mean, like once in a generation thinker, maybe longer, right? Like it could very well last longer than a generation, but yeah, it's just an absolute like polymath and expert in many areas to have created it. And I think like if we're being 100% honest with ourselves, like I don't think he knew that it would come to this. Like I think that he created it, and if he believed that it would come to what it is, he would have put way more of about it in the white paper. It wouldn't have been as like, you know, P2P electronic payment system,
payments,
right? Like,
yeah, right.
It would have been way more than that.
But here's something. Okay, so I've thought about this too.
Yeah, I would love to hear your take.
If Satoshi gamed this out, then you realize that the start of money, the galaxy brain comes out, and the start of money is like as a collectible and a tradable between like a small number of people, right? And so he's going to put this out on the cypherpunk mailing list, and he knows that it's just going to be this kind of small group of like cypherpunks and internet nerds and gold bugs and libertarians that are going to like find this thing interesting enough to like, you know, dabble in it. So then you you would write a white paper like that, and you know, to kind of incept this thing, because if you said like this is going to be the next global reserve currency, like, you know, I'm not sure that it would catch the attention of these, like this small band of people who needed to shepherd it to that end. I don't know. Maybe I'm just like putting too much into
wow.
it, but
like you,
right.
I need to reread it again. I feel like,
I don't know, man.
this whole podcast, one, has made me extremely bullish, and two, now I'm like, shit, I got to read it again with new eyes. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. It's if you could go back and like hindsight 2020, it literally, I mean, it's been almost perfect, right? But like, would you have done it that way again? Or are there ways that you could have done it faster? Like, you know, there's one thing, you know, I don't come from Silicon Valley, but, you know, we raise money from like, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, people. And one debate I have is that Bitcoin could not be created by venture capitalists. They just don't get it. They don't, it's a totally different thing. I'm still today, you know, talking to a lot of venture capitalists that like don't truly get Bitcoin. And and even to this day, like, you know, 12 years later, whatever. So like, I feel like it has this thing about it that it had, maybe it had to have started on a forum, you know, like it did. And maybe it had to have, you know, kind of come from outside, like one belief I have is like, it had to come from outside of the Valley or from outside venture capital, because it, you know, truthfully, if it was like a centralized company, it probably would have been shut down. I mean, Satoshi would be in jail and everybody else would have been scared to touch it. But the fact that you like, you know, maybe he was killed, maybe he was found, but like, you know, the fact that he didn't start it from like traditional means, like made it even more powerful. But like he had to have been like one of the smartest people of all time to predict that like hundreds of chess moves that have occurred, thousands of chess moves. Because think about like everything that has happened that has like, you know, the way that Bitcoin has meandered throughout society over the last 12 years. I don't know if like a computer could have predicted this, like, let alone a human being predicted everything that we have seen. COVID, here's a good example. True. We're going to look back and we're going to say COVID accelerated. If COVID didn't happen, we might be 10 years behind where we're going to be at.
Absolutely.
Like I didn't believe in a hyper Bitcoinization future for the next 25, 30 years, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. And now like, I'm actually thinking it might be within the next 10 years because of COVID. So how would you have predicted that? And how, you know, would you have predicted that the US would have had a moment in the lifespan before like banning Bitcoin, before they had the ability to ban Bitcoin? Would they have had a moment where money printer go burr to the point where everyone's freaking out looking for the truth and like drawing all this attention to Bitcoin? Like how would you have predicted that?
I agree with you that you couldn't have predicted the way it was going to unfold, but I think you could imagine the general impact that, a non-debasable, unconfiscatable money could have on society, right? Because it's fundamentally different than what we had. And it's, Satoshi definitely have knowledge, like this is like flipping the script. It's Hal Finney had some amazing, you know, kind of prescient thoughts about how things would develop and in terms of like, the power of miners and Bitcoin banks being developed and stuff like that. And like this being more of like a financial system, part of a financial system instead of just, internet payments thing. I don't know.
It's
just fascinating to go back and think, you know?
If we are there are writings, I believe, in the early conversations where he does talk about it is a response to the financial system, the existing financial system, and how broken it was, and the events of 2009 financial crisis were like what inspired it, and so maybe it is safe to say he could have predicted something was going to happen. There are cycles of recessions and recession should have come way sooner. Like I think what was the stat? Like we've never been gone this long without having a recession, some sort of like economic correction. So I guess playing devil's advocate as I like to do against myself all the time. It's like, maybe he did predict it, and maybe it was like longer than he thought, even though I think that this course correction of, it is definitely more dramatic given COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was, the whole Austrian school of economics that kind of carried the flag for sound money against, just waves and waves of just ideas and power and, consensus against it. Right. Like it seems pretty obvious. Those guys who were working on like Eagle, like Chaum, and who was also like sound money maximalist, kind of guy, or at least, understood Austrian economics and had a different way of thinking about money, and the gold bugs who were like, oh, we need to, the Ron Paul, contingent, we got to audit the Fed and we need to go back on a gold standard, and, the fiat money like leads to this inevitable end. Founding fathers talked about, had this debate about central banking too. I mean, it was a big kind of federal part of the Federalist, anti-Federalist arguments that were going on. We went back and forth for 150 years fighting between, having a central bank, abolishing the central bank, having a central bank, until it's finally kind of stuck in 1913. But those ideas were there. And I just feel like Satoshi had this vision, like, this is the thing that could fix money, like, forever. I don't know. It's crazy to think about. I just think that, and then if you had that idea, to not make those grand claims might be a strategic choice. I don't know. I just wish you're right. Like fly on the wall, in these corporate boardrooms, and just imagine being a fly on the wall in the room where stuff was being coded up,
Yeah, that would be amazing. I'd love to know. But there's something there's almost like this element that if we did know, it wouldn't be as powerful as it is. It's kind of like when you read a really good book and like fiction, and the book almost always is like better than the movie because you fill in all the gaps. And the human brain is an incredible thing, right? Like, you know, we can't recreate it. It's absolutely incredible. And it has this ability to fill in all the blanks of something. And then when you watch the movie, you're like, this is how somebody else's brain interpreted the thing that my brain did. And it's why we love books better, because you're seeing something in your own, you know, vision of like what you thought that thing should be. Bitcoin, everyone, because there was so many gaps in it, like source of truth, yes. Finite rules, yes. Like 21 million things, everybody knows it. Like simple, you know, 8 pages, whatever. Like everybody knows that. But the fact that there was so many ways that you could come about it, like when you look at like the type of person that is attracted to Bitcoin, it comes from all these different realms. Like it's libertarians, it's mm-hmm. liberals, it's like everybody loves it because it attracts so many people, because you can look at it and you can fill in all the blanks and you can basically be like, okay, I'm looking for the truth, and you can fit it to fit the viewpoints that you have. And it is, you know, so nonpartisan that there's like strength in the fact that there are gaps, if that makes sense. Because it is not, it's like, it's defined at its core, but it leaves so much open for interpretation. And that's where there's so many different sects that can be attracted to it. And it wouldn't, if it was more defined in like its vision and what it was going to do, governments would be way more scared. Like 100%. People would be way more scared of this thing than they are. And so it's like perfect in its imperfections is maybe that's the way of describing it. Because it was not defined of what would happen, where you look at it and like, if you're like, you know, at the Fed of some country, you're like, oh, that's cute. It's an 8-page paper. Cool. Like, you know, but now you can't stop it. It's like the snowball effect, or like this boulder coming down the mountain. Nobody's stopping it. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And like, what are you going to do now? And it's what started as like this cute little white paper is now this like behemoth that is like almost unstoppable. Like, like it's getting there.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's there, man. So what do? You just
stack sats.
You buy
stack sats every day.
Like, you use Lolly to make your purchases. You know, you
DCAN.
Yeah. And that's what you do.
Can we talk about, I haven't talked about this on the podcast yet, and it might be controversial, but I love things that are controversial, and I'm curious your take on it. NFTs.
Okay. I've been thinking about them more. There's been a lot more discussion about them lately.
Yeah. I always like, I have this moment where like, you know, I reserve my thoughts. You know, I've been thinking about NFTs for actually way longer than just, I'm not just like just getting into them. I love art. I love I think going back to my core philosophy is like, you know, free market, giving people access. Everybody should have access to the Mona Lisa, and like, you know, owning pieces of the Mona Lisa, right? Like everybody should have access to the best art in the world. And so there's principles of NFTs that I actually think are very in line with Bitcoin. And would I trade my Bitcoin for NFTs? No. But like, you know, there are things about like, you know, NFTs that are very interesting and parallel that actually like, I think lead it to a debate of like, what is its interaction with the Bitcoin ecosystem, and what are NFTs worth, and how can they interact on top of Bitcoin rails? So I'd love kind of reverse the question and hear your thoughts on NFTs, where you're at, where you think like some cool things that are going to happen with it.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm just now really starting to think about it, just like really in the past few weeks, because I've had some discussions on Clubhouse about it. Mm-hmm. And Brecky, you know, who's a Bitcoin artist. I've had some discussions with him about it as well. You know, even going back like a year ago, and he was like, well, I'm not going to do it if it's on Ethereum, but you know, there's stuff happening on Bitcoin. that's, you know, and that is here now. Yeah, I don't know. My thing about it is, like, if you're holding, I guess I could see the value. I don't see much value in like having a non-fungible token for a single piece of art. To me, it's like having a certificate signed by the, you know, by the artist. Like, this is, I made this, and you know, you sign a certificate or something. It's the same thing. Like, if you want to put it on the blockchain, that's cool, because I think that's, you know, kind of hip and would be fun to have. Like, you know, you go to a Block Explorer and look it up, and here's the signed, you know, cryptographically provable like signature instead of a paper certificate. That's cool, but I don't see much of a difference. But I, the idea of like owning a piece of something could be interesting. You know, and like sharing, you know, sharing, like buying a share of the Mona Lisa, as an investment or something could be interesting, and having it like, I mean, you could still do that with a centralized database, and, you know, check to make sure that you still have that share or whatever. There's no like funny business going on, or just like a federated database, or have some auditor, you know, check it or whatever. There are like ways to make that happen, but you know,
I don't know though.
You could do it on a layer of Bitcoin. Like, why not? Like,
why not?
You know,
yeah.
Why not? Like, why not? I don't see, I, you know, if it's an upper layer, like it makes no sense to do it on the base chain. It's just going to get too expensive. And that's obviously going to be like an international settlement layer. But yeah, on upper layers, if you have like protocols built on top of Lightning, like RGB tokens or something, like, why not? You know?
Yeah, I think it's going to get cool. It's also, I think, a very critical moment for Bitcoin, because if I'm being, you know, objective, I would say it makes the most sense. It's the biggest. One of my objections with Ethereum, and I don't think I'm as critical of Ethereum, I think, as most, you know, Bitcoiners are. Now I'm, you know, clearly like Bitcoin bull, but and you know, maxi, but at the same time, like, I think that Ethereum just hasn't served society in the way that Bitcoin has, and I'm waiting for it to. And like, the dream of ETH2 is nice, but it's like, show me, kind of, don't sit, tell me. But the reason why I wanted to bring up NFTs is like, I want to see people building for it. Because art has value. It's like, yep, the same. It's like, you are willing to pay for something that has value, and the access to art. Like, if everybody can cryptographically say that I own a piece of this like digital artwork, and I believe it has this amount of value, and someone else believes it has this amount of value, it has value. So I think it's going to be an incredibly critical moment for Ethereum and a very critical moment for Bitcoin. And I kind of look at it as like, these two entities can like fight over it. And Ethereum right now is definitely winning in the NFT space. If you're sort of like looking at the tug of war, because there's all these developers that are building on top of the Ethereum, on top of Ethereum, and NFTs. So I think it's actually the best case for Ethereum that I've ever seen, because it takes something that has real value, that I think we all agree that art has value. And then, like, when you look at what the source of that is and what you're going to price it in, like, I'd love to live in a world where we're pricing art in Bitcoin. I mean, I want to live in a world where we're pricing everything in Bitcoin, things in Satoshis. But right now, if you look at all these different NFT marketplaces, they're all being priced in Ethereum, which is a bull case for Ethereum. And you can argue over like gas prices and scalability, but people are still paying for it. And like, so it's a very interesting moment that I think that I'm not seeing enough Bitcoiners talk about this fight. I haven't seen anyone talk about it. Like, where are the builders, you know, coming in to say, let's go build, you know, Bitcoin and its interaction with NFTs and price the future of art in Satoshis. And
there are definitely, people starting. It's just, it's much fewer than are on Ethereum. Ethereum definitely has a big head start on that. Like, my take is, okay, so, you know, like, Pomp back in the day, like 2017, tokenized the world, right?
Yeah.
And the idea of like, this stuff would happen on like, you know, a bunch of different chains. Like, there'd be a chain for real estate tokens, and there'd be a chain for art tokens, and there'd be a chain for this. Like, that was fundamentally wrong. I could see, you know, building tokens on top of Bitcoin, and obviously it's being done on top of Ethereum. It's being done on top of Bitcoin, starting to be done on top of Bitcoin, on Lightning and RGB protocols, and the guys at like Atomic Finance are doing some interesting things with like decentralized betting and oracles and things like that that could prove useful in NFTs. So I see like if to me, the reason I'm a maximalist is there are like, this is a protocol for the transfer of wealth over the internet and the building a financial app on top of that money. And I see this as a protocol stack. I think like the LNP BP idea, you know, that we're building right now, like is a stack that can, you know, lots of other protocols and applications could be built on top of it, just like TCP/IP. And network effect efficiencies just say that, like, you know, there's going to be one internet protocol stack. And like, I see LNP BP as the transfer of wealth protocol stack on top of TCP/IP and the rest of it. And then there's money, the network effect of money too, right? So like, if we all converge on a single money, the shelling points, there's that network effect. So it's like this dual network effect thing. So you can't escape it. Like, there's going to be one. So in my opinion, so like, I think what's happening on Ethereum, and with lots of, like, if you look at other cryptocurrencies, like our experiments that Bitcoin can learn from, right? And so if there's demand for NFTs, eventually it'll come to Bitcoin because people want the underlying money and the underlying technology that guarantees the value of those NFTs or the security of them or the provability of them to be the best, right? And to be the one that everyone else is using. So in that regard, Bitcoin's way, 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 way ahead of Ethereum. So that's where I'm at. Like, if it's going to have value, it'll come to Bitcoin eventually.
Because it's just fair, fair. Yeah, play the long game as we always have.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to call to action because I feel like I haven't seen enough people building in it, and I want people to like not like there's this tendency. There's like two camps, right? There's like the dogmatic, I won't even look at anything. I won't touch anything.
Yeah,
NFTs
sure.
are bad because they're on Ethereum. And like, I'm not in that camp. I'm the opposite of that camp.
I don't think I am either.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I just want, you know, listeners out there and for it to be known, like, you know, this is a very real thing. NFTs are inevitable. And like, I think there is a play here of somebody who wants to like dedicate the next like 10, 15 years to go building what is that intersection? I don't know what it is. I haven't figured it out yet. But what is that intersection between Bitcoin and NFTs? And what does that look like? Because there's something there, and I don't know what that is. But I am thinking about it in my quote unquote free time.
Those spare brain cycles that get eaten up by Bitcoin. I think there's, you know, there's much more extensible and simpler and approachable programming languages that are being built for these systems on top of Lightning. And so I think that's going to help a lot. And I think one of the reasons that there's like a lower barrier to entry for a lot of developers in Ethereum, I think that's being corrected. Like, I think that's being evened out within Bitcoin now. So like, I talked to those guys at Atomic Finance. God, I can't remember their names right now. And I'm sorry if you guys are listening. But they said that they left Ethereum for that reason. Like, they wanted to build on Bitcoin, but it was hard and Ethereum was easier. So they built on Ethereum. And when these tools came to Bitcoin, they started building on top of Lightning, with this new programming language that's out there to build on top of Lightning. And it's like, they've put it together in a really short amount of time, really quick amount of time. And like, it's working and, it's interesting. So I think like there's precedent now, and like that's starting to happen. So I think, I think it'll eventually can, you know, come over to Bitcoin. There's the call to action. All right, Bitcoiners, like, if you're listening, you're a coder, you want to make something happen, like, go ahead and look at Ethereum, look at what there's demand for and start building it on Bitcoin. Right. I mean,
yeah,
you know, yeah. Well, man, I think, I don't know. I feel like we've kind of reached a natural conclusion for this particular conversation. That was a lot of fun.
Great, great combo, man. Good, very divergent, very fun. I love it. So, thank you for having me on the show again, and we'll talk soon.
All right, man. Take care, Alex. Thanks to Alex for joining me. You can find him on Twitter at Alex Adelman. That's at AlexAdelman. You can find Lolly at lolly.com, LOLLI. I am at Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Share this one with your family and friends. The bull is here. Get them on board. Head over to swanbitcoin.com. Start stacking some sats. You can grab your referral page at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. Become part of the Swan Force, ENLIST. And you'll have a referral code. Share that with your family and friends, and you'll stack 25% of Swan fees for every purchase they make. Fantastic deal. Thanks again to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. I appreciate your support of this podcast. You can check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's some cool stuff there to check out. You can also get some Swan merch at zazzle.com/swanbitcoin. And also check out the podcast I've created for Swan, Swan Signal Podcast. It's an audio archive of our weekly Swan Signal Live broadcasts at swansignalpodcast.com. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. My DMs are always open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram as well. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.